Baloscha really contains two major themes. The first, the preparation of the Jewish people for their eventual entrance into the land of Israel. Parsha begins with certain laws to Aaron to light the candles, laws specific to Levim. But the general theme of the beginning part of the Parsha is how the people encamped and how they were ready to travel, and the formation of the people in traveling toward their destination, which they felt was imminent, toward the land of Israel. We have the laws of the Chatzotros, the laws of the trumpets, the laws of the Anan, the cloud, how the whole system worked so perfectly that the people knew exactly when to travel, how to pack up their bags, and how to move. And indeed, we find Moshe Rabbeinu turning to his father-in-law Yitro and saying to him, Nosima nachzor al hamakom, we're traveling right now to a land of Israel. Vayita lanu leinayim, and you'll be for us, for eyes, as a guide. Come with us to the land. In their minds, they were really on, as the Rav calls it, the grand march to Israel. And we really would expect that very soon the book of Bamidbar would end, and we would have as the last verse, and the children of Israel entered the land of Israel. Perhaps the climax of this first part of the Parsha is found in those two very famous sentences that are marked off by inverted nuns. Vayhi ben Soa Aaron, when the ark went forth, Moshe said, Arise, O God, and scatter your enemies. Let your foes flee before you. The Aaron headed the people. The Aaron was ready to go straight into the land as a lead. And when the enemies would see the Aaron, they would just scatter. Had they not sinned in the sin of the Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies, there would have not been necessity for war. The Jewish people were able to walk into the land, says Rashi, and they'd be able to conquer it with ease. And in the second verse in this selection, and when it came to rest, he said, Return, O God, to the myriads of Israel's thousands. This is the climax. This is the height. The Aaron moving, the Aaron resting. The Jewish people, without any delay, were supposed to enter the land of Israel. That's the first part of the parasha. Right after the sentences of Vayhi ben Soa Aaron and Uvenucho Yomar, we begin the downhill, slippery slope that ultimately leads, as Rav Hirsch points out, to the exile of Jewish people from the land of Israel. And this downhill slope begins where the people began to complain. Vayi'am ki mit'onanim rab al znei Hashem, and it was evil in God's ears. When God heard it, he displayed his anger, and God's fire flared out, consuming the edge of the camp. So we have the people complaining. We don't know quite what they're complaining about, but that is enough for God to send down a fire and consume a number of the people. As a result of that, and the name of the place was Tahavirah, burning, we find that the Asasu, which is translated in English as a mixed multitude among the Israelites, began to have strong cravings, hitavu tava, and the Israelites once again began to weep. Who's going to give us some meat to eat, they demanded. We fondly remember the fish that we could eat in Egypt at no cost, along with the cucumbers, melon, leeks, onions, and garlic. When Moshe heard them crying at the entrance of their tents, he turned to Hashem and he said, Why are you treating me so badly? Don't you like me anymore? Why do you place such a burden upon me? Was I the woman who was pregnant with this nation in my belly? Did I give birth to them? But you told me that I must carry them in my bosom as a nurse carries an infant until we come to a land you swore to their ancestors. And further, says Moshe, where can I get enough meat to give all these people? So we find Moshe Rabbeinu complaining to God, saying, I can't handle the situation anymore. Do something about it. This is really beyond me. Kadosh Baruch Hu's response, he goes so far to say, if you're going to do this to me, says Moshe, just do me a favor and kill me. Don't let me see myself get into such a terrible predicament. To which Kadosh Baruch Hu immediately responds, assemble 70 of Israel's elders, the ones you know to be the people's elders and leaders, bring them to communion tent and let them stand there with you, and when I lower my essence and speak to you there, I will cause some of the spirit that you possess to emanate, and I will grant it to them as well. So we find here that the people are complaining. We don't know quite what they're complaining about. Immediately a fire comes down and consumes them. After this incident, we find the people having a desire, particularly a desire for meat, remembering the fish they ate in Egypt for free. Moshe Rabbeinu throwing up his hands and saying, I can't handle this anymore. And Kadosh Baruch Hu's response is, I will give you 70 elders to help you, as well as giving them the meat. We know that they gathered the meat and they just were like gluttons in gathering the meat. Many people died in this instance. It's called Kivrot HaTava, the burial place of desire. And the parasha ends with the story of Miriam and Aaron speaking negatively about Moshe Rabbeinu. Next week's parasha is the sending of the spies, the Korach, and again the downhill slope, how instead of entering Israel almost immediately, it took them over 40 years to get there in total. Quite a number of questions that we need to analyze and to understand to get somewhat of a glimpse into this parasha. And clearly this is going to be two approaches of many, but nevertheless fascinating approaches to offer us a larger mindset on what the story is all about. The first question is, we know the Gemara tells us in Shabbos that there's an opinion that states that there are not, as we commonly say, Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the five books of Moshe, but indeed that there's seven books of the Torah. There's the book of Bereishit, the book of Shemot, there's the book of Vayikra, and then there's the book of Bamidbar until Vayhi ben Soa Aron. Then the two verses of Vayhi ben Soa Aron, which are marked off by these inverted nun, is a sefer b'fnei atzmo, is a separate book of the Chamisha, now, not the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, but the seven books of the Torah. And then you have Vayhi ben Soa Aron until the, from the end of Vayhi ben Soa Aron to the end of Bamidbar. That's book number six. And the book number seven is the book of Devarim, the final book of the Chumash. So our first question is, it seems a little bit odd that we have an entire book of Chumash of two psukim, and these two psukim don't even teach us any laws. They're very nice. When the Aron traveled, Moshe prayed that the enemy should scatter. And when the ark settled, Moshe prayed that God should return his glory upon the people. They're very beautiful verses. But to create an entire Sefer Torah, to create an entire book of the Torah based on two verses, seems a little bit strange. Question number one is, how do we understand what is the theme, what is the purpose of this book in and of its own right? The second question is to understand the function of the nuns. What is the function of these inverted nuns? Why was specifically the letter nun chosen? Further, we need to understand, what is this complaining about of the people? What is this desire that they had for meat? They had plenty of meat, as Rashi tells them. They had sonu bakar, they had sheep and cattle. Why are the people suddenly complaining that they want to eat meat? Go to their flock, shech the meat and eat it. Bring a korban, eat the meat. How are we to understand this desire of eating meat, remembering the fish that they ate for free? How are we to understand their complaints in general? Continuing along with our questions, we further need to understand Moshe Rabbeinu's response. And as the Rav points out in Reflections of the Rav, it is so uncharacteristic of Moshe Rabbeinu to respond in this manner. You have, for example, the sin of the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, where clearly here the people committed a tremendous crime, the crime of Avodah Zarah, of idolatry. And what's Moshe Rabbeinu's response? He defends the people to the end limit. And he says to Kadosh Baruch Hu, Mecheni na mesifrecha asher katavta, erase me from the book. I don't want to have anything to do with your book if you're going to kill off these people. A tremendous, tremendous stalwart in the honor of, for the honor of the people. Chet HaMeraglim, he stands up and invokes the Yud-Gimel Midos, the 13 attributes of mercy of God. In this case, they're asking for some meat. Not a major thing, they want some meat. Okay, they want a hamburger for dinner. They want a steak for dinner. And suddenly Moshe Rabbeinu's response is, what? Did I give birth to these people? You want me to carry these people? To the point he said, I'd rather die, I can't handle this anymore. It seems so uncharacteristic of Moshe Rabbeinu. What is it about wanting some meat that evokes such a strong response? And a final question is, Kadosh Baruch Hu's response. The way Kadosh Baruch Hu responds to Moshe is by saying, you know what, I'm going to give you 70 elders. And I'm not just giving you 70 elders to help you, I'm giving you 70 elders who are going to be filled with prophecy as well, that I will give you of my spirit upon them. How is that a response to the demand of the people for more meat if there are more elders around? What they want is meat. They don't want more prophecy. They don't want more elders. They want meat. How are we to understand this entire story? So these are the questions that we clearly have to grapple with in understanding our parasha and understanding what exactly went wrong here, that they go from tremendous heights of Vayhi ben Soa Aron crashing down to such tremendous depths. I'd like to try to take today two approaches. And what's so beautiful about these two approaches is that they are diametrically opposite approaches in understanding the people. The first approach will look at the people as real rabble-rousers, people who are on a very low spiritual level, and then we'll move 180 degrees and look at these people as very high, elevated, lofty levels, which is important just for us to get a perspective and an insight into the myriads of levels of understanding a portion within Chumash. The first approach I'd like to take is based primarily on a Klei Yikar and then the understanding of Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, on this section. A very, very fascinating Klei Yikar. It's worth going through the entire thing. We will go through selections. The Klei Yikar notes on the verse of Vayhi ben So'aron, quoting the statement we mentioned previously, that these two verses are sefer b'fnei atzmo, a book in their own right, and therefore there are seven books in the Torah. To which the Klei Yikar notes, V'chi yipalei mimcha davar lemor. Perhaps you're wondering by saying, Harei ikara Torah l'mitzvot ha'nitna. The whole purpose of the Torah is for mitzvot. Hu b'sefer zeh ein remez l'shum mitzvah. But we don't have any hint of any mitzvah in this selection. So explains the Klei Yikar, no, you do have a hint. And then I will offer my own portion, my own insight. Ve'omer, and I will suggest, Shilamitzvat Piryav Rivya Asa Sefer Bifnei Atzmo. There is alluded to in this section of these two verses a very fundamental and important mitzvah, the mitzvah of procreation, the mitzvah of Puruvu. Continues the Klei Yikar, ki b'mitzvah zu, talui kiyum ha'olam v'goreim hashrat hashchina. Because we know it's through this mitzvah that we have the continuation of the world, and we have the Ashras Hashchina, we have the Divine Providence resting in this world. As our rabbis tell us, the Gemara in Yevamos, Kol mi sheino seik b'piryav v'rivya goreim l'shchina shetistalek m'Yisrael. Anyone who's not involved in the mitzvah Puruvu is causing the Shchina, the Divine Providence, to leave the Jewish people. Now how do we have hinted in these two verses a hint at the mitzvah of Puruvu? So explains the Klei Yikar very simply. Uvenucho yomar, when it comes to rest, so then return, O God, to the myriads of Israel thousand. So that's how the Klei Yikar explains that we see from here that the Shechina only rests on Rivavos Alfe Yisrael, on Rivavos, a minimum of 20,000, Rivavah is 10, Rivavot is 20,000, and Alfe is a minimum of 2, a minimum of 22,000 people. So if a person would not involve himself in Puruvu, and there would be less people, so he would be causing the Sila Kashchina, he'd be causing the Divine Presence to leave from Israel. So that's how the Klei Yikar explains the mitzvah, that we learn the mitzvah of Puruvu from this verse, that Kadosh Baruch Hu Shechina will rest only if there are a tremendous amount of people in this world. And if there aren't this amount of people, so then there'll be a Sila Kashchina, there'll be a Divine Presence leaving. But the Klei Yikar goes one step further, and he says that if we take this premise, so then the next sections make a lot of sense. Because we then can understand why in the next section we have the people complaining. Explains the Klei Yikar that all of this is hinted at in the letter of the Nun. The two inverted nuns that we know in Aramaic, nun is dag, is fish, that the people were complaining about this concept that here Moshe is expecting them to have a lot of children like fish. We know that fish procreate on a very large mass level. So the nuns, by the Vehib and Saron, is a reference to fish, which we know is a symbol of fertility to a certain degree, and that the people are being demanded that they should have a lot of children. At this point, Vahiyam Kimitarnanim, the people are complaining, explains the Klei Yikar, they're like an Onain. In Onain, we know the state right before burial, where a person is not allowed to have marital relations, is a state where a person can't have children, halachically. So, explains the people are starting to complain, and they say, we feel like we're an Onain. We're restricted in the amount of children we're allowed to have. On the one hand, Moshe, you're telling me that we should have a lot of children, puruvu, be like the fish. But on the other hand, and that's why the inverted nuns, you're restricting us by the laws of erva, by the laws of who we're allowed to marry and who we are not allowed to marry, how many children we can have. Because if we could marry anyone we want to, so we have a lot of children. But if now, Moshe Rabbeinu, you're coming along and saying, on the one hand, we have to have a lot of children. On the other hand, we can't marry anyone we want to marry. And there are certain restrictions on who we marry. So therefore, we're not going to have as many children as perhaps we could have if we'd marry anyone we'd want. So what they're really complaining about here is they're complaining about the restrictions of arayos, these restrictions of who they can marry and who they cannot marry. And that's how the Kleyoker explains that this Asasuf, who we know are the mixed multitudes, the Eruv Rav, that came with the people that converted from Egypt, that they were the ones who were really carrying the bandwagon here. Because Egypt, we know, was a place of shtufei zima, of tremendous morality, of people marrying whoever they'd like to marry. So these people are the ones who felt the most strongly about how can we have these restrictions of who we're allowed to marry, and yet we're supposed to have a lot of children. And that's how, says the Kleyoker, based on our rabbis, he explains, Hitavu tava, they had a desire. What was their desire? Their desire wasn't for meat in the physical sense of a hamburger or steak for dinner. It was rather a euphemism for flesh, for relationships. And that's also remembering the fish we ate in Egypt for free. Remembering those relationships that we had in free in Egypt that now were so constricted. And that's how the Kleyoker understands this whole section, as has nothing to do with the physical food of meat or the physical fish that they ate in Egypt. It rather has everything to do with the desires that they had in order to have any relationship with anyone who they would like to. Taking this one step further and one step deeper, that's how the Rav explains the different reaction that Moshe Rabbeinu had to, let's say, the sin of the golden calf and the sin here of Kibros HaTava. And the Rav explains, he says, we need to understand a brief analysis of idolatry. And the Rav continues in Reflections of the Rav and notes, there's what we call idolatry, which signifies actual worship, ritual and cultic performances, specific acts that one did for the idols or to be represented by them. In addition, there's also paganism, that involves a cultural system, a manner of living. Our sages were convinced that idol worship inevitably leads to paganism, that worship influences the society's way of life. Yet paganism can persist even after idol worship has been discarded, like the later Greeks and Romans cast aside idol worship, but still live a pagan lifestyle and value system. Continues the Rav, what is paganism and how does it contrast with the Torah outlook? The pagan worships deities which represent forces in nature. These deities are themselves without moral norms, and they make no demand of man beyond specific acts. For man lustily to partake of nature is, therefore, an act of identifying with such gods. Man actually sees himself as coexistence to nature, and therefore craves unlimited indulgence. In Judaism, man's divine image manifests itself precisely in his self-control, the subordination of his craving and lust to the will of God. It is God the Creator who is to be worshipped, not nature, which is merely a creation. To worship God is to submit to a code of do's and don'ts. To worship nature is to abandon all norms and restrictions and to regard all that is possible as permissible, to acknowledge no restraints in the human appetite. And the Rav says that the Torah detested the pagan way of life even more than it hated idol worship. Because idol worship is just worshiping a certain idol and doing specific acts in order for the idol to do certain things for the person. But paganism is a whole culture, a whole way of thinking, which makes no specific demands on a person, but really allows a person to be involved in all the lusts and desires a person may want to have. And that's why the Rav explains that the Kibros HaTava episode, however, revealed that even without idol worship, paganism still exercised its hold upon the people, a remnant of their long stay in Egypt. And where we really see this is the way the Torah describes the gathering of the quails, an insatiable accumulation of property and the gratification of hungry senses characteristic of paganism. When God had these quails come to the camp in order to supply them with food, so the Torah tells us that the people rose up all that day and all the night, and all the next day, and they gathered the quails. And he that gathered the leaves gathered 10 heaps, and they spread them out all around the camp. We have here desire going berserk, a craving without any restraints. This was a rebellion against all inhibitions. And that's how the Rav, echoing Rashi and the Klayakar, explain that who shall give us flesh was a pretext. It's a euphemism for that which is sensual. Remember the fish we ate in Egypt, our sages explained, refer to sexual morality. The licentiousness which the Torah now restricted, since fish have a prodigious proliferation capacity. When Moshe heard the people weeping among the families, the people wailing, explains Rashi, because of family matters, because the intermarriage of blood relatives was now forbidden to them. The oral tradition, as expressed by our sages, understood Kivrota Tava as an orgy of the senses and idealization of unrestricted indulgence. What's really fascinating is to compare this to the Jewish view and the food that Kadosh Baruch Hu gave the Jewish people, which is the man, which we know no matter how much you took, whether you took more or you took less, you walked home with the exact same amount of man. There is limitations, there is restriction, there is control. These are two societies, one pitted against the other. The quail of the imagery of people going all that day and all the next, all that night and all the next day and just gathering, gathering, gathering. And the picture of the man of self-restraint, of being able to take exactly that which they need, not more and not less. If we understand that what's going on here is not just a rebellion, not just idol worship, but it's a whole mentality of a society that's longing for hedonistic pleasure, that's longing for pleasure without any restraint, without any control, so we can understand here Moshe Rabbeinu's such severe reaction. Because as the Rav continues by explaining, he says when Moshe Rabbeinu was originally given this job to be the leader in Egypt, the qualification that Moshe Rabbeinu needed was to be a teacher, was to be the leader, was to teach the people Torah. And that is why, indeed, when it comes to a question of being a leader and being a teacher, in regards to idol worship, so Moshe Rabbeinu could sit the people down and explain to them, you know, we believe in one God, we don't believe in other gods, we don't believe in intermediary. You should worship one God. It's an intellectual exercise, and it could train the people. But here, we're not dealing with an intellectual question. We're dealing with passions. We're dealing with emotions. We're dealing with people whose desires know no control, no limitations. And that's why the Rav says there's a big difference between a teacher and a nursing mother. The Rav explains the teacher instructs a child and a nursing mother also teaches a child. The latter, however, in addition to teaching, also carries the child in her bosom. She submerges her identity in that of the child, making her own ambitions secondary or nullifying them completely. The needs of the child take precedence of her own life, and she becomes one with the child and finds fulfillment through them. There is an emotional fusion of two identities. A teacher ever retains his own identity and personality. His is an intellectual communication of specific knowledge. And that's why, in this case, continues the Rav, Moshe now became aware that being a teacher was not enough for a leader of Israel, a manhig Yisrael. The people in its early formative years needed him as a baby needs a nursing mother. They were temperamental, impulsive, filled with uncontrollable desires, restively murmuring. He would not only have to teach and command, but also guide, train, and transform a people inclined to paganism into an Am Skula. Besides teaching, he would have to reach out emotionally to the people, nurture them through their national infancy with patient, sympathetic understanding and empathy, as a nursing father would do. He was the Ava Nivi'im, forced to withdraw from his ordinary preoccupations and attachments in order to nurture a people in its formative years, a people cardinally important in the Almighty's plan for the world. For this role of an Omein, Moshe felt unqualified. Teaching was simply not enough. Now we can understand why Moshe's response was such a harsh response. Kill me, I can't handle this. Did I give birth to these people? Moshe Rabbeinu is turning to God and says, if you want me to be an intellectual leader, I'm ready, I'm qualified. You want me to be a father, you want me to train these people, you want me to handle them like a little toddler, where they have these uncontrollable desires, right? They want the whole chocolate cake, and they want the whole chocolate cake now, and they don't understand that dinner is going to be in 10 minutes.
That's a whole new qualification. To take a people like that and make them into an Am Skula, make them into a treasure nation, that's going to take a whole different job description. And hence, Kadosh Baruch Hu's response was indeed to give him 70 princes, some of the elders who are going to have prophecy within them, who would have that ability, that have that intuition, have that nature to be able to handle these people and to help Moshe Rabbeinu transform these people into a nation that could serve God. So on the first level, we have here a story of people who on their way, on the verge of entering Israel, said, we can't handle this lifestyle. We can't handle lifestyle restriction. You're telling us, by even so, Aaron, that the precondition of having God's Shekhinah, Divine Presence, among us, is to have a lot of children. And you're also telling us that we have to restrict those whom we can marry, the inverted nuns, the inverted fish, that we can't be just like fish in the way we would like to be. So then they really became angry. They had this murmuring against God. God responds fire with fire, fire with passion, with outer fire, as the Klei Yikar explains. The people desire a desire of meat. They actually verbalize their desire. Meat is clearly a euphemism for sensual pleasure. And this is what Moshe Rabbeinu throws up his hands and says, this is not what I got myself into. This is a paganistic culture, philosophy, society, and I need help in dealing with these people. I think the moral implications of this level for our lives are clear. And I think they're twofold. One based on the second point, and one really based on the whole concept. In terms of the second point, we mentioned that the role of Moshe Rabbeinu as the role of a teacher is different in a pagan society than an idol worship society. It's really lesson number one, an important lesson for us in terms of ourselves teaching our children and whom we hire to teach our children. As the Rav explains, our age is demonstrably pagan. Without idol worship as such, it consists of uninhibited indulgence. The teaching role may have been sufficient in the past to counter the allurements of other religions, philosophy, and the pseudo-ideologies which still abound nowadays. But the paganism of our day requires that the elements of the omein, the nursing father, be combined with the teaching role, particularly since the emotional introspective element is so pronounced in contemporary human relationships. What we require is a warm embrace as much as a brilliant idea. Sympathetic understanding, true befriending, and a human reaching out, a suggestion to our modern misonanim, restless, complaining ones, that we care. The teaching role is inadequate in its own right. And as the Rav explains, this must be pursued with dignity, with self-respect, rather than shallow sentimentality. So I think the first thing which is clear is that we are dealing with this society, which is a society of paganism. The children, the generation that we teach, is a generation of desires, of wants, of needs, of all of these physical pleasures. And they take these physical pleasures so for granted. You know, it's a beautiful story that Rabbi Fran told a number of years ago, one of his tapes, I believe it's quoted in one of his books as well, of a child that comes, plays by another child's house, and I don't know if it was Shabbos, whatever day of the week it was, and the child wants to be picked up, and says to his friend, can I use your phone to call my parents to pick me up? So the child says, I'm sorry, you'll have to wait because my parents are on the phone. So the child immediately says to his friend, well, okay, so give me the second line. It was so understood in his mind that every house has a second line that, of course, just give me the second line, I'll call my parents on the second line. That story, which was, I don't know, told 5-6 years ago, wherever it was, today the story would have a different ending. It would be, if you don't have a second line, so of course you have a cell phone, right? We live in a society where kids take for granted that every house has a second line. Every house has a fax line. Of course everyone has a cell phone. Perhaps every member of the house has a cell phone. I myself know this. I've been dealing with the last number of years where I have cell phones going off in the classroom. Forget about beepers. Not the cell phones. We're living in an age where everyone has a cell phone. A 15-year-old kid has a cell phone. This is a society of wants, of needs, of desires. And to a certain extent, going berserk, unless we can control them, bring them in. Such a society cannot just handle the teaching role, the teaching modality. They need the sympathetic ear. They need the warm embrace. They need that concept of the omein, of the nursing teacher role to be able to transmit values to the children. And the second idea that I think that we can learn from this for our own lives is, as Rabbi Feuer notes in Tehillim Treasury, the forbidden fruit that the sinner consumes has an exquisite taste, but it comes at an exorbitant cost. For nothing is more precious than peace of mind, and that is the price the sinner pays for going to war with God. He forfeits the serenity of his spirit, for he's betrayed his divine essence. When we exercise self-control of our desires, we feel a sense of wholesomeness and consistency. But when, in a moment of weakness, we surrender our first part for our lives, is the importance of knowing self-control. That so much self-indulgence is not going to lead to peace of mind, is not going to lead to serenity. It's the ability of having these restrictions. It's the ability of having this is what I'm allowed and this is what I'm not allowed that we have of Ubenuchol Yoma. When the ark settles down, we have the Shuvah Hashem Rivvos Alfa Yisrael, that God rests among us. We have the Shechina, we have the divine providence when we're able to hold back, when we're able to have restraint. And I think the perfect example of that is in last week's Sunday LA Times, where Andrea Hyman writes how she really lived a life of basically all these different pleasures we've been talking about in life. Been there, done that, tried out all these exotic places and people and interesting things in life, but none of that gave her satisfaction, none of that gave her pleasure. And it was only through embracing Orthodox Judaism that she found that it's through the self-control and the self-restraint that you find beauty in life. It's through the dating experience with her husband of going rowing a boat in Central Park without any physical contact until after marriage, that the physical contact had any meaning, had any depth to it. And this is what we're talking about in life. This is but an example on a modern day level where it's really through the self-control and the restraint that we do find Uvenuchol Yomar, the Shechina, the divine presence, really resting among us. This is level number one. Let's now turn to the second level, which is going to look at this section on a completely different level. As a background to the second level, I'd like to do a very important fundamental principle which is based on Rav Dessler, which Rabbi Tatz and the Thinking Guide for Jewish Teenagers develops, and this will serve as a background to understanding the second level as the Nesiva Shalom, the Summoner Rebbe, explains it. The concept of Rav Dessler that Rabbi Tatz develops is a concept called free will, Bechira Chofshi. And we know that every single person has in life free will. But as Rabbi Tatz notes, once you're free, your point of free will moves as you make a choice. As you handle a free will ordeal, you rise or fall. If you win in your battle with your own lower self, if you overcome your temptation and choose the higher path in your ordeal, you immediately become a higher person. As you exert effort to defeat the temptation, as you push through the test successfully, you rise. Just as physical exertion against resistance builds muscles, so spiritual effort builds spiritual power. As you overcome your own immaturity, you develop your inner being. As you conquer tests, you conquer yourself. You take control and you build yourself. But then Rabbi Tatz goes on and explains, as you conquer ordeals, you must face more difficult ordeals. As you grow, you are given tests which are more difficult. Just as an athlete must face ever stronger opponents as he develops skill in order for the game to remain a challenge, so must you face even more difficult tests in order for your free will to remain free. Because if you grew as a result of a test, but the next test remained as easy as the previous one, you would immediately outgrow free choice. It's like when a player outgrows the Little League, it would be pointless and ridiculous to continue playing with children. For free choice to remain free, your point of free choice must rise as you rise. So if you ask why your deals become more difficult as you grow, why your negativity grows with your positivity, the answer is that you are here to exercise your free will, and the only way to do that throughout life is to be faced with ordeals which are pitched exactly at your level always. And as your level goes up, your tests become more difficult. And as Rabbi Tatz concludes on this idea, just as the previous ordeal was pitched exactly at the point where your positive and negative drives were locked in a life and death struggle for supremacy, So too, the new ordeal is pitched at your new point of free choice. Both sides of your character are more powerful, and the battle is fought again. But you are greater, the enemy within is more powerful, and the stakes are higher. You are closer to your inner potential. The final victory of life is that much closer. You have become a more worthy opponent of your own darker side, and of course, you are further to fall if you fail. This idea that everyone in life has free choice, and where we see where we exercise our free choice is in the concept of nishyonos, the concept of ordeals. And as we grow in life, our ordeals grow as well, and they become much more difficult as we grow stronger and stronger. This is a fundamental concept within Jewish thought, that it's not that we remain stagnant and our ordeals remain stagnant, but rather as we grow, our ordeals increase with the severity based on our levels of growth. In understanding this, so we can now have a deeper understanding of these two verses of Vayihi Aharon and Uvenucho Yomar. Explains to the Siva Shalom, he says, some aspects of the Torah are actual mitzvot that we do in action. And there are other aspects that are teaching us how to act in the service of God, how to be good people. How we can really fulfill all 613 mitzvot. And how do we comply? We have the Parsha, which is a Sefer Bifnei Atzmo, we have a selection, which is a book in its own right. It's teaching us how to keep Torah mitzvot. And here, the Nesiv Shalom, quoting the Magid of Kushnitz, Zchuto Yagen Aleinu, may his memory be a merit for us, explains that by he been so Aron, she understood allegorically, that the Aron is Romeis, is hinting at the Tamid Chacham, the scholar who has the Torah within him. And just like the Aron, the physical ark, had the Luchos, had the commandments, had the Aseret HaDibrot within them, so too the Aron really represents the individual. He mentions the Tamid Chacham, we can by extension say every individual who learns Torah, who's involved in Torah and mitzvot, so we become a mini Aron, just like the Aron had within it Torah and mitzvot. So we too have Torah mitzvot within us. And therefore, when we speak about Vayihi Soa Aron, when the Aron travels, it's not just speaking about the physical Aron, that traveling, but allegorically it's about the individual who has the Torah mitzvot within them, how they travel through life, through all the nisyonos, through all the difficulties. How they are moving from difficulty to difficulty. And after they go through one difficulty, one challenge, one ordeal, they move from one level to another. Because as we just mentioned, after every ordeal, a person rises and deals with a different, more lofty, more difficult challenge in life. It is gidulim achar gidulim. It's one level after another. And therefore, says the Nesiva Shalom the following. Moshe is davening for the people. And he's saying, Kuma Hashem, Hashem, get up, Veheye Bezratam. Be a help to them. Shelo Yiplu Chas V'Shalom, that they should not fall, but rather Yitchasku V'Yalu V'Yoter V'Yoter. Let them be strengthened and go stronger and stronger. And let their enemies, which are the Kochot Hara, the negative forces in this world, not to be able to withstand on this person. Explains to the Siva Shalom so beautifully. Vayihi ben Soa Aron is talking about life. When the Aron moves, when we move from challenge to challenge, when we move and our free will is being tested, it's a tefillah kum Hashem, help us out. Help the individual out as they go through life. Because the whole point of a person coming to this world is to be on a shlichus, is to be on a mission from God. And we're asking God to please help us. Moshe Rabbeinu is asking God to help people out in life, in these challenges, and allow the enemies to be scattered so they should not have a negative effect upon the people. And we know, taking this one step further, philosophical level, Rabbi Tatz explains in the World Mask, based on the Derech Hashem, that this concept of going through challenges is really the concept why God created the world. And he knows very briefly a very important idea. He says that the Derech Hashem states that the purpose of creation is, very briefly, that Hashem is good. Goodness necessarily implies giving. One cannot be good in isolation. Benefit to that which is beyond self is a necessary element in the idea of goodness. In fact, it's the entire concept. Now, in order to give, a receiver is necessary. And that's why Hashem created man. Man is that creature whose reason for existence is to receive from the Creator. And in order to give man the ultimate pleasure, the ultimate goodness, Hashem created the next world. And the purpose of the next world is that we should have the greatest goodness possible, which is to experience the closest with God, have a unity with God, is able to receive. Man is that creation able to receive that greatest goodness possible, God Himself. However, as we know, to receive that ultimate inexpressible goodness and pleasure unearned free would not be pleasure at all. This is the concept of the bread of shame. When a person receives a free handout, that person feels shame and helpless and inadequate. One who receives charity hardly feels alive. The purpose of this world is to provide the opportunity to earn the next. This world is the place in which a man is free to work of his own accord, free to generate his own perfection, free to generate his existence in the next world. This world is dark and full of challenge. It is designed to provide the stage on which man operates to actualize his potential. His tools are the challenges of this world and his free choice to grapple with those challenges and overcome them. And that is the purpose of creation. This world to work and earn, the next world to enjoy the reward, the results of the work. Our work in this world is necessary so we not feel the shame of living on free gifts. If we understand that the whole challenge of this world is to be able to work, to go through the challenges of this world in order to get our reward in the next world, so we can appreciate that all the challenges and all the difficulties that we go through are in order for us to come to a level of closeness with God, not only in this world, but ultimately in the next world, and that's where Schar and Onesh, which is where our divine reward and punishment come to place. Now understand, perhaps, the story of the Asasuf, the story of the people who are desiring a desire, and what this story is all about, looking at the people on a high spiritual level. And this is based on the Leket Sichos Musar, the Slobodka Rosh Yeshiva, who says that we know that there's one opinion in the Medrash that the Asasuf, according to the first approach, would be the Erev Rav, the mixed multitude. According to this approach, these are the people who are the Sanhedrin, the Medrash says, based on the verse, Yisvali Shivimish, gather for me 70 individuals. Asasuf, from the word Asaf, those who are gathered. So the Asasuf are not just the rabble-rousers, the lowest part of the nation. Fakir, they're the highest part of the nation. They're the Sanhedrin. And about them, and it said they had Hitavu Tava, they had a desire. Explains the Leket Sichos Musar, Shetiyel lahem ta'hem hitavu ta'ava. They had a desire to have a desire. Shetiyel lahem ta'ava. They wanted the desire shiyu gashmim to be more physical. Lo kefi shayu az, not like they were at that time, b'metzav elyon, on a very high level. She'ein lahem milchamat yetzer klal. They had hardly any challenges of the yetzer, of their inclinations at all. U'memei lehem makom l'schar v'onesh. And they felt they weren't getting a place for reward and punishment. The people living at the time of the desert had very few real challenges in life. Their food was taken care of for them. Their clothes were washed by the Anunei HaKavod. All their physical needs were taken care of. They didn't need to relieve themselves physically. Everything was taken care of completely for them. To dedicate themselves, but completely, to learning Torah. To sit and contemplate God all day. So these people said, you know what? If life is about struggle, if life is about having difficulties in life, if that's where we're going to gain the ultimate closeness to God in the world to come, so then we want to have some challenges in this world. We don't want to live so easily in this world. It was very reminiscent of the way Rav Dessler explains the sin of Adam Arishon. Life is too easy here. Let me sin. Let me fall. Let me then bring upon myself more challenges. And in overcoming those thought Adam Arishon, I'll be able to gain a greater closeness to God, a more deserving closeness to God. However, this approach is a very difficult approach, because we know that the Gemara tells us, Lo'olam lo yavi adam atzmo lidei nisayon. A person should never bring upon themselves a challenge in life. We shouldn't desire challenges. They come in life. Unfortunately, they come too often in life. But we should not be the ones who bring them upon us in life. V'kadosh Baruch Hu therefore had the Amli Dei Nisayon, and that's why God did try them. And He gave them the meat. And if they really wanted the meat in order to overcome their desires, so that then they should have stepped back from having the meat. They should have been able to overcome the desire or eat it in a manner of Kedusha. The fact that they didn't shows that they did not withstand this test. The way they ate in a very gluttonous manner shows that they failed in this test. But with this understanding, what they're wanting is a greater spiritual level. It says in Leket Sichos Musar, we can understand why the response was to have more prophets, more Kedusha, more holiness in the people. That we should have a society which is going to have increased Kedusha, increased prophecy, in order for the people to have more of an understanding of what does it mean to gain closeness from God. And in this respect, we can understand why Moshe Rabbeinu got so upset. Because it's not just the first part of the pasuk of Vayihi Soa Aron is a directive in life on how to behave, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should help us out in our trials in life. But there's a second part of life as well, and that's the second verse, Uvenu Chol Yomar. Continues in the Siva Shalom. D'achar Shiyudi Kvar Mitzgaber Al Nisyonot. After a person goes through these trials, V'kavash Et HaYetzer Hara, and he conquers his inclination. Adayin Lo Siyem Shlichuto, he has not finished his Shlichus, his message. Shemata, from now, Mutel Ralav HaShlichut Ba'asei Tov, he has to involve himself in the positive, which is that he has to now work on the Avas Hashem and the Dveikus Hashem, the love of God, the clinging to God. This is the request of Moshe Rabbeinu. Uvenucho, from the language of Menucha V'Nachat, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should rest his Shechina among the people, and that we should have this closeness with God. This is a concept we've spoken about before, that when the Jewish people encamped in Parshas Masay, the verse says, Vayisu Vayachanu, they encamped and they rested. Life is about movement and resting. But just like we have all those mountains of movement, there are plenty of valleys in life as well. Quiet. There are times when perhaps we're not going through an immediate challenge right now. But those are the times that we have to connect with God. Those are the times that we have to cry out and say, how am I getting closer to God now? I'm not being challenged at this very moment. But where am I standing in my relationship to God? So I don't have a major crisis on my head. But when I wake up in the morning and I say Moda'ani and I do Negavasar, do I feel that today is going to be one dedicated to Avodas Hashem, to the service of God? Do I feel connected even if I don't have an outside force connecting me to God? Uvenucho Yomar is also a tefillah, that when things are quiet, that Tshuva Hashem, we're able to have this relationship with God. And it's at this point we understand why Moshe Rabbeinu got so upset. When the people are sitting and learning Torah all day and there are no challenges, this is not the time to ask for challenges. This is the time to take that opportunity and say, let me grow closer to my relationship with God. Let me take the time that I have now and develop and enhance and increase that relationship with God. Moshe Rabbeinu is saying to the people, here you are. You're at the point of sitting at the footsteps of Har Sinai, literally gaining all this Torah. And at this point, you're saying you don't feel close enough to God that you need to have challenges in life. What more can I do? Get rid of me. Kill me. I can't handle this anymore. Here I am. I'm bringing the people to a state where they have this closeness to God. What am I? Am I a mother that's going to have to carry them in my bosom? How much more do I have to take them by the hand and bring them to this relationship of closeness? They're standing at the foot of Mount Sinai. They have this closeness. They're learning Torah Mipia Gvura. What more do you want from me? And this is why, according to the second level, Moshe got so frustrated that although their intentions were very good intentions, they needed to understand that there's a Menuchol Yomar. They needed to understand that you're able to find spirituality in the quiet times. Hence, more prophets to be able to help the people and direct them at this time. And in this level, the Nun, the inverted Nuns, explains where we left and outlooks and insights, represents Namanut, the aspect of faithfulness and consistency, says the Gemara. The inverted nuns therefore represent inconsistency and self-contradiction. The faithfulness in the Vahibin Soa when we travel. The consistency in the Venukho Yomar when we rest of our relationship with God. And therefore, in summary, Vahibin Soa Aaron on the first level is the mitzvah of being fruitful and multiply. The desire or desire was a desire of paganism, unrestricted desires. Moshe's leadership has to be now turned into a teacher-parent role. The lesson, restricted pleasures, is what brings one closer to God. The second level, Vahibin Soa Aaron, are trials and rest periods in life. The desire and desire is wanting to be challenged. Moshe's leadership, he feels if he can't bring the people at this level closer to God, then nothing's going to do it. Therefore, increase spirituality for the people, people to help people come closer to God. But the clear lesson is that in times of serenity, it's also a time of closeness, not only the troubled times in life. It's the peaks and the valleys that we have to ask ourselves, by even so Aaron and Uvenu Kol Yomar, how am I getting closer to God, growing in my relationship with God? How am I a different person as a result of all that a person goes through in life?